Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. This episode is brought to you by Fruit Carts. Come on, Chaseys, what did we ever do to you?
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man, sort of a new thing for the MacGuffin Man. I have some friends that know things better than I know things, so sometimes I will be basically interviewing them. Today we've got the MacGuffin Man's senior comic book specialist in the studio. His name is Travis Taylor. So welcome, Travis.
Hi, Alex. Nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. We both like comic book movies. I know a little bit about comic books. You generally know more and care more about it all than me.
Well, not like screaming in fights or anything like
no,
that.
No, no.
I don't know. I've been following comics since I was little and kind of got back into it when I started university.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's about it. And I've been spending way too much money since on comics at the store. So
yeah, well, I suppose we all have our things. Luckily, I found cheap enough movie tickets throughout the city that, you know, it worked out.
Another reason to move back.
let's start with some basic stuff, like any favorite comic book superheroes.
Sure. I'm generally of the belief that there's no such thing as a bad idea. So I tend to, when I'm reading comics, I tend to follow writers more so than I do particular characters.
Okay.
I think as with any guy my age that reads comics, I would buy anything with Batman on it. When I was younger, I really liked Green Lantern and Iron Man. I was really surprised to see those characters sort of come to prominence in these movies. And that Robert Downey Jr. was just perfect in the first Iron Man, at least. I think Daredevil is underrated in popular culture, in part because of the movie.
I think the movie had a big hand in that.
I'm a Daredevil apologist for the movie, so we'll
really?
Get into that later. I think it's a character that's attracted a higher caliber of writer and I guess artist a lot of the time too. Marvel's been very careful with it and has done very well by Daredevil, I think. And I'm surprised that that hasn't been rolled into any more mainstream success for the character.
Okay, well, and that's the thing. Like, the character is super interesting. And, I mean, I've never read a Daredevil comic book in my life, but just from watching all of those Marvel animated shows that were thrown at me as a kid, like, I enjoy the general origin story and the idea of the blind superhero with, like, the sort of...
Did they do the origin story in any of the cartoons? I don't remember him showing up like once in Spider-Man.
They must have, because I know it. And I don't, if unless I read the Daredevil comic book and just sort of forgot about it.
Well, it was in the movie. Did you actually?
Yeah, no, but I would have known it. I did see the movie.
I knew it
going in. So, okay. Yeah, I mean, I was disappointed in the movie, but...
Okay.
Because I do think the character is cool, and it was just an unfortunate movie.
Yeah, I mean, the setting kind of... lends itself for anybody that hasn't seen Ben Affleck's masterpiece Daredevil the movie or read any books. Daredevil is a blind lawyer in the Hell's Kitchen neighborhood of New York, and it sort of gives a particular mood to the whole thing. He's blinded as a child by as with everything else in the 60s, a radioactive isotope falling from a poorly secured truck.
Yeah, there were radioactive isotope.
They're
being everywhere.
They're more tightly regulated now, the radioactive isotopes. And he was blinded as a child, but has sort of like a sonar sense. His other senses were heightened, but I mean, really, it's the sonar sense. So he sees and is more aware of the world than most people. One of the sort of famous tricks is that he can be sort of like a human lie detector. You can sense when people's heartbeats are skipping, if they're lying or if they're telling the truth, presumably with absolute accuracy. And by day, he's a lawyer. A lot of pro bono cases. I mean, I have a hard time getting a sense of exactly how rich he is in terms of being a lawyer.
Yeah.
I don't know. They have more money than I do, I guess. So, Frank Miller cut his teeth on Daredevil. So a lot of the sort of...
Frank Miller, famous for to movie fans for Sin City, mostly, and also directed The Spirit, which... film fans might know existed.
I've never seen it.
Yeah,
I've never seen The Spirit. It was sort of like a... he did a lot of more noir stories. Some significant characters getting killed off. There was sort of a first for comics, whereas now characters are getting killed every month, like major characters, to sort of artificially induce a sense of peril that anything could happen. I think Frank Miller was sort of... not the first, but it was a... things felt more severe. He was doing sort of similar to Sin City noir writing. It was very urban. It felt very New York in the 1980s. And I was reading on the bus ride here, Born Again, which is apparently the source material for when they're rebooting the Daredevil franchise.
Okay. And, like, for the movie or?
For doing another movie.
Okay.
They're planning on writing they've commissioned a screenplay on this comic called Born Again, which is about Daredevil has his secret identity found out and he's basically ruined. They destroy his home. They attempt to kill his partner. Is his law partner, not his, like, Daredevil's never had a sidekick, but his law partner. And it's sort of a deconstruction thing where he gets his life ruined and has to claw his way back. And I think he's homeless for a good portion of this book. Okay. And it's very much like early Sin City. And
he is an interesting character, and that's, again, why the movie was so disappointing. And the only thing I really remember from that movie is the D in Flames, reflected in Joe Pantoliano's glasses or something like that.
I thought that was okay.
I thought that was so corny.
Joe Pantoliano was really good in it, though.
Joe Pantoliano is good in everything, though.
The only other person I could think of for that character, Ben Urich, the reporter who's in this Born Again story.
That's Joe Pantoliano's character?
Yeah, that's Joe Pantoliano's character. He knows, in the comics, he knows Daredevil's secret identity for a very long time, and it's a different relationship than it is in the movie. But the only other person to play him that I could think of was sort of like a Steve Buscemi, like sort of a twerpy guy.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. I mean, that's sort of the same vein of person as Joey Pants, right?
Yeah, I guess.
Do you have any favorite comic book superhero movies? Well, I assume you do. What are they?
Yeah, a couple. Christopher Nolan's Batman. Although I did watch
it's a very creative choice.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So I have some alternate answers as well.
Yeah.
You know this. I'm a Superman Returns apologist as well.
I also am.
Oh, there. Right. Yeah. I thought that we had... I've argued about this with somebody that really hated it. I think Daredevil is underrated. It's not great, but I think that it has some elements that hadn't really been introduced before. It came out in 2003, which is sort of pre-Batman Begins, but also after the first Spider-Man and X-Men movies.
Yeah, yeah. It would have been after X-Men 2, wouldn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Or maybe the same year.
Yeah, and Spider-Man 2, I think, is probably one of the high watermarks for me.
Spider-Man 2. The action in Spider-Man 2 is so cool. All the stuff where he's fighting Dr. Octopus and...
Yeah, the scale, and it was one of the first ones where I think that they did the action, and it doesn't look like a set all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Any of the scenes in the first one, they're sort of confined rooftops, or if you look at the shots individually, even when, like, Green Goblin is attacking that parade, they always cut away to, like, things that look like sets and sort of plastic bits of building falling off.
No, I know, and that's sort of one of the things about Sam Raimi movies in general for me is that... And I find this with Tim Burton a lot. You can really tell they're on sets as opposed to, like, in places, like in on location, basically.
Another friend that I talk about this subject with a lot, his big selling point for superhero movies a lot, and I think action movies in general, is the sense of place. Mm-hmm. And very few of them have gotten that right. I think the first X-Men one is weird. The second one, they're very isolated, and a lot of it's very indoors, and, like, they're underground at the end of the movie. The first four Batman movies, for most of them, they don't really feel like a place. They just sort of feel like different sets put together.
Yeah, no, and I mean, Tim Burton directed the first two Batmans, and that's sort of my general complaint about Tim Burton movies. And, I mean, Batman 3 and 4 were kind of just not very good in general. So, I mean...
Batman Forever was better than I remember. I watched the first half of it the other night, and... There were parts of it that were more interesting than I thought would be.
Really?
I was shocked.
Because I never saw it when it was, initially came out. I probably didn't see it until I was, like, 18 or 19. And I was just like, this is just trash. I would rather watch Batman and Robin again before I would watch Batman Forever again.
It was campy, and the plot has a lot of holes, but it did a better job of Batman and Bruce Wayne as a character, I think, and talking about his psychoses. And that and Daredevil, actually, I think are two that suffered because of studio interference. There are director's cuts of both of those movies now that sort of put them in a different direction. The Daredevil one, it's an R-rated movie.
Really?
A lot of the romance stuff is cut out. There's a subplot, and you're going to laugh at me for this. There's a subplot involving Matt Murdock defending a character played by Coolio. also in Batman and Robin. Some sort of thing, and Matt Murdock knows that he's innocent, and Coolio knows that he's innocent, obviously, and there was more of a... It had a little bit more to do with his character, with Matt Murdock's character, and Yeah, okay. I don't know.
All right. Well, I suppose
I haven't seen it in a while. I was going to watch it before I came here so I could give it a thorough apologizing for her. But
well, that's fine. I mean, I assume the reason I sort of never gave Daredevil that benefit of the doubt is that the only other movie, I think it's Mark Steven Johnson is the director's name, that he did was Ghost Rider.
He's directed something else. Has he? I had thought he had. I
okay, well, we can do a quick Google.
Okay. Yeah, Ghost Rider was not good, though. Although they're in the middle of shooting a second one that's coming at the end of the year, again with Nick Cage, but being directed by Neville Dean and Taylor. I don't know their first names, but the guys that did Crank. Crank, and the action sequences are set up in a similar way, that they're just sort of a little bit more unconventionally shot than a lot of other films. So I'm interested to see what happens. I mean, I don't have any real investment in Ghost Rider or maybe Nick Cage.
I enjoy Nicolas Cage. I mean, I've written about it and talked about it at length. But yeah, Mark Steven Johnson, director of Daredevil and Ghost Rider. The only movie he did before Daredevil, Simon Birch.
Oh my God.
So yeah, I don't know how that really matches up. But,
I've never seen Simon Birch.
I mean, it's not very good. People liked it because it was very heartwarming, but, you know. And, yeah, we didn't really talk about Superman Returns, but I'd like to go back to it because I always like talking about Superman Returns, and you're pretty much the only person I can talk about it with.
Sure.
So, yeah, I really think it's a good movie. I mean, I don't care too much for the first four Superman movies in general, but I just sort of like the sort of...
Wait, not even the first one?
I didn't see it a lot when I was a kid, and I feel like maybe the effects were just too dated when I got into it, and it's just sort of a total, mostly different filmmaking style.
Do you have that issue with older, with most older movies?
No, just sort of spectacle movies, like older blockbusters.
So, like, you can go back and watch Jaws and have it have the effect that...
Yeah, because Jaws is fairly basic in its special effects and stuff like that.
Okay. Never actually seen Jaws. I just kind of used it because I know that people describe it as one of the groundbreaking movies.
Yeah,
one of the first big blockbusters, I guess.
Yes. But yeah, in Superman Returns, I really like that. It's a very graceful movie, I think you could say. I really enjoy the score. I really enjoy, I suppose, I don't like Kate Bosworth that much, but I enjoy the romance aspect of the movie. I think it's pretty decent when they're flying around and, you know, like the why did you leave conversation. I just really like that.
Yeah, it was kind of, it felt like the love story aspect of it was, and Bryan Singer said that he was intending to bring female viewers into the theater because they obviously... At the time, it wasn't generally thought that women were going to blockbusters for the most part. And it kind of introduced a weird dynamic. And I mean, especially with the kid, it wasn't a nuclear family dynamic like I would imagine you would expect Superman to be, the first Superman movie in 20 years or something like that. Yeah, it did some interesting things that were unconventional, but it was also very tied to the first couple movies. I mean... Stylistically, it looks exactly like it. Brandon Routh is essentially doing a Christopher Reeve impersonation. Kevin Spacey is playing Gene Hackman for most of it.
Yeah, he's a little bit different from Gene Hackman. More different than Brandon Routh, Christopher Reeve thing, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, but it was definitely, the movie, it was stylistically, is tied to the first four. It's a loose sequel. It's not a reimagining. It takes place after these other movies. And I think that was one of its problems too. I think I liked that at first, but on a rewatching, I didn't really love that aspect of it. I should have done something more. I wish stylistically it had gone in a different direction or been more not as constrained to the other movie's continuity.
Yeah, I certainly get that. And I don't know. And the only really good action sequence the movie has is that airplane sequence, which is about like the 40-minute mark, and I think it's really, really good. Or even before the 40-minute mark. And then he just lifts up a giant island of kryptonite later in the movie, which is kind of shenanigans. But, you know, I enjoyed the movie, aside from the lack of good action, I suppose.
It was essentially the same plot as Superman the movie, in that it's Lex Luthor is making a land grab by... In the first one, he severs California, or he tries to sever California from the continental United States with a missile. And in this one, he's creating an artificial landmass. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of, it was the same plot device, I guess. I don't know.
I guess the other thing I really enjoyed about it was the whole, like, what if Superman existed and then left for a bit, you know? And if anything, I don't think they did enough with that.
I don't even think that that's really been done in the comics that much. And, like, Have you read Kingdom Come?
Yes, yes, sir.
I think that's the only one I can think of where he... Well, they did something at the time of Superman Returns, but it was very brief. And he doesn't leave. He just kind of stops using his powers. Yeah. I haven't read it, but other than that, there's no other major storylines where this character leaves.
Yeah, because I feel like just chaos. It would just be like riots. Pretty, like, all the criminals would just go wild. It's like, okay, he's gone.
Yeah.
You know, there would be like a week where people are like doing little petty crimes. Like, can I get away with this? And then after, like, oh, he's gone, you know, just sacking New York City or Metropolis or whatever you have it.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of depends on the universe that they're writing. And in comics, you have sort of this shared universe and where people can step, or like other superpowered people can step in. I mean, literally hundreds of superhumans in the United States and not really anywhere else. Again, I think it was their deregulation of radioactive isotopes in the 1960s that must have caused this superheroic baby boom.
Yeah.
But yeah, in the movie you have this character who's presumably the only in Batman, I guess, the only vigilante character doing these things, or Spider-Man or Superman as the only characters in the world that have sort of supernatural or extra normal abilities. Mm-hmm. And I was reading, they did a questionnaire with Robert Downey Jr. and Jon Favreau about the Avengers and Iron Man 3. And the biggest problem they're having with writing it right now is that they don't really know how to, or they have to figure out a way around, well, did the Avengers just have their cell phones turned off? Like, how do you address a threat and have it not just be the Avengers 2?
Yeah.
You know, why would he not call a guy with a giant hammer if he could?
Yeah. No. And I mean, I think of the Avengers, Thor is least likely to have a cell phone, but
they're omnipotent. They're gods. Yeah. They have that, well, yeah, exactly. Crystal thing.
Yeah. But I mean, and we're going to touch on the Marvel universe a little bit later.
Sorry to jump
but,
in.
Oh, no, that's fine. But how about any least favorite superhero movies?
X3. Yeah. X3 was my biggest disappointment.
It had so many ideas in it.
Kind of. And I mean, after having seen X-Men First Class and knowing that Bryan Singer and Matthew Vaughn had so many things that could have gone into it that would have made it such a great capstone to the first and second movie, mm-hmm. It's such a missed opportunity. Wolverine was terrible. Ghost Rider. I think that they almost tried to put too much of the comics in the Ghost Rider one.
Okay.
Because it's not like Batman where you can point to 10 New York Times bestseller books and say, we're going to do that idea, or we're going to do this story and have it begin and end here. There's like two really great Ghost Rider stories by Garth Ennis. I forget what they're called, but they're the only ones that Garth Ennis has done. And
see the guy that did Preacher?
Yes.
Okay.
They're very similar to Preacher in tone, and that's why I think it would have been really cool to go in that direction with it. But it just kind of ended up being a sloppy mess of with no consistent tone. I don't know. I think giving Ghost Rider this much of my breath is probably not a good use of my time.
No, so. Fair enough. Well, I enjoyed Ghost Rider as I was watching it, but I did not enjoy it for any sort of level of quality. It's just one of those movies that had Nick Cage in it, so I was like, I have to see it. And then I did, and I enjoyed it, and I liked Nick's kitschiness.
It wasn't the worst. I mean, I really liked it was Peter Fonda played Mephisto. I'm not sure what the Marvel devil, the Satan is called.
Yeah.
And the guy from The Big Lebowski, the sheriff, not the sheriff, the nameless cowboy.
Oh, Sam Shepard?
Yeah, Sam Shepard was good in it, but like they didn't really do anything with
it. No, it's not Sam Shepard. Sam Shepard's...
Sam Elliott?
Sam Elliott, that's it. Sam Shepard's the guy in Days of Heaven.
Didn't really do anything with it. I don't know. Anyways, it was Ghost Rider, X3, Wolverine. Spider-Man 3 was a similar problem. Too many things happening at once, and it lost the coherence that the second one had. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Other than that, I don't have any huge complaints. I mean, the biggest problem with most of them is that they're made by committee. They're made by shareholders. And yeah, I don't know. People that aren't familiar with comics and not really knowing what to look for, like they're picking ideas. They're sort of cherry picking ideas, but not really doing them in a way with a consistent tone.
Yeah.
So it just kind of ends up being like, it's not a comic book, but they're not really great movies. So there's just kind of this amorphous, weird, disappointing thing a lot of the time.
Do you think there's been a sort of shift to paying more attention to things like tone since, say, I don't know, let's say maybe starting with Batman Begins or something like that, where you just studios seem to be willing to give more leniency to a director or something. Like, I feel like The Dark Knight doesn't get made pre X2, you know?
No.
And I mean, I think since X, and I mean, X3, clearly bad ideas and, well, it rushed and all that. And,
yeah, it's, well, X3 went through something like 5 directors.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's a matter of too many cooks in the kitchen. And it's kind of the case with the developing any kind of art, I think. I mean, I'm a big believer in consistent authorship will bring you consistent tone, and people will bring you their ideas. And I'm not saying unfiltered. I mean, in comics, obviously, they answer to an editor, and you're working with artists and things like that. But to have 5 directors on a movie is never a good idea.
It's never a good sign for any movie, you know, let alone a movie that's sort of going with a franchise as it's been sort of established, as well as this big canon of stories, right?
Does that happen outside of sort of the blockbuster?
No, I doubt it. I mean, sometimes you'll get sort of a drama that's had maybe like $30 million put into it or something, and you'll get a director fired or something, but it only happens on this scale in blockbuster movies. Like, I know this isn't a comic book, but it's a older property as well. The G.I. Joe movie, Steven Summers was fired like in the editing of that movie.
The Wolfman was the same problem.
Yeah, Wolfman, just the studio just kept being like, no, we don't like this, change this, change this, change this.
I was surprised I only found out that was Mark Romanek the other day. He was the director on The Wolfman.
Like original?
Yeah. Oh, okay. He directed it until like right up until they started shooting, and then it was Joe Johnson. And after having seen Never Let Me Go, yeah, which I really liked.
I thought it was a really good movie.
It just seemed like the Wolfman. This is the guy that's going to be the Wolfman. He was on. Yeah, I think he was on the short list too for the Wolverine sequel that they're currently trying to get back on track.
Yeah, yeah. No, I thought the Wolfman was it had interesting ideas. Like, it seemed really Shakespeare. And it seemed like a movie that had a really good script and had maybe like 20 extra minutes that were cut out, and things just didn't really work in production, but it seemed like it would have a good script. Anyway.
Back on track.
Yeah.
Back to the script.
any favorite casting choices?
I liked Kevin, I liked the ad announcement, Kevin Spacey as Lex Luthor. I think his material was off and on throughout the movie. Liam Neeson was a really good Ra's al Ghul, like different than in the comics, but Liam Neeson always plays a good dad figure.
Yeah. He's been Qui-Gon Jinn since 1999, basically, in every movie. Or he's been the guy in Taken, just striking throats.
I've never seen Taken.
Oh, it's so good. It's like it's a Seagal movie with a really good lead actor.
You promised to reenact it for me later? I don't know if
I want
to.
Yes, of course. Okay. People are going to die, but I will reenact it.
Willem Dafoe is the Green Goblin. I thought was really good. Like, he's got the perfect face for a villain like that, but then they cover him.
Because he looks like a goblin.
And they cover him in a Power Rangers mask or something. Michael Fassbender as Magneto was perfect.
Yeah, he was great. And I think we're very much in the majority on that one. I haven't seen anybody, critics or regular person, say anything bad about him.
Kelsey Grammer is the Beast, but again, bad material. It was the Beast from the comics and from the animated series, like, on screen. It was perfect. Michael Clark Duncan did a good Kingpin in the neglected Daredevil movie, I thought. Over the top, but that was kind of the tone of the movie. It was a little silly. I think Jennifer Lawrence as Mystique and Gwyneth Paltrow as Pepper Potts are underrated. I've heard a lot of hate directed towards Gwyneth Paltrow in particular, and I'm surprised. I thought that they were good. I was going through my list, and I realized they were all men, and I was trying to think of women that have been good. But a lot of the times, the female character is the weak link, I think, just because they don't really know what to do with a female character in an action movie. I mean, it's a similar problem in a lot of movies where the like a male figure is the protagonist.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on Pepper Potts. I thought she was a great character, and the fact that somebody was able to sort of keep up with Tony Stark in the Iron Man movies, like, verbally, is very good, very interesting, and my only issue with her is that she really just seems like the fallback girl for whenever he decides. Well, I mean, she pretty clearly is the fallback girl for whenever he decides to stop just, you know, banging everybody.
In that questionnaire that I mentioned earlier, this is really interesting, actually. The LA Times held their, I think it was the LA Times. Anyways, the Hero Complex film festival where they ran all of the Marvel movies. They ran Superman the movie. I think they ran Wrath of Khan and sort of other things in that canon. They were talking about all the ways that they wanted to go with Iron Man 2. And there is, you can watch it on YouTube or on the DVD, there's an alternate beginning that starts with Tony Stark puking in the plane.
Okay.
When they're talking, before he jumps out of it in the Stark Expo, he's puking and he's having all these problems. They had another idea that they had scripted but never shot, where the movie opens with him waking up having just slept with Pepper Potts and not knowing what to do.
Okay.
And like, obviously, I don't think they were going to do that in a summer blockbuster, but it was a very interesting idea. And I really liked their chemistry. I thought it was great. They talked to each other like real people. She spoke with genuine disappointment in him, and not in a, like, you left me at the station kind of way, but just kind of wanting him to be better but not knowing what to do about it. And yeah, like you said, keeping up with him.
Yeah.
It was good. It was really great.
And especially in blockbusters, you rarely get sort of a female lead that really keeps up with the protagonist and is just as likable. And sort of.
And it can outdo Terrence Howard.
Yeah, well.
Acting chops.
Well, Terrence Howard just takes everything so seriously. I hate Terrence Howard, man. Yeah. He's awful.
This is not the Terrence Howard-friendly show.
No. Yeah. He's somewhere crafting a character in the caves of Ireland or something with Daniel Day-Lewis, and Daniel Day-Lewis is trying to get him to leave. That's what's happening with Terrence Howard right now.
Fair enough.
So let's, any least favorite casting?
Rewatching Spider-Man 2, my biggest problem is Kristen Dunst and Tobey Maguire. I think they're the weak link, and I think they had no chemistry whatsoever. And he freaks me the hell out.
Yeah, I agree.
He was a good, if you're at a Google terminal, look up Steve Ditko's, you can go ahead typing at this. Steve Ditko's Peter Parker, he was a good sort of awkward, like, creepy B-movie protagonist. With his glasses, he just kind of is awkward and doesn't fit in. And the movie is, the older comics are kind of like B-movies, and that's sort of what Sam Raimi chose to do. And it works well in the first one. And then in the second one, when they're adults, it doesn't, his sort of vacant look doesn't really do it for me. He looks really strange, and it seems like he's not really listening to when he's having conversations with people. His monologues are bad, and like I said, they have no chemistry whatsoever. It was just not great.
Okay.
Which is why I'm looking forward to Andrew Garfield being hopefully 500 Days of Spider-Man.
That concept is really interesting to me, the whole teen movie and Spider-Man. It's like putting one of my favorite movie formats together with one of my favorite characters, you know.
You've been reading Ultimate Spider-Man.
I read the first volume.
And I think in part rumored to be some of the source material, or at least some of the ideas and tone for the next movie. What do you think? I have to turn the tables and ask you questions. I don't know if I'm out of line, but
I really enjoyed the volume I read. It was sort of like the first 13 issues in Ultimate Spider-Man, and it was very teen movie-esque, sort of really dealing a lot in the high school and sort of the relationship between Mary Jane and Peter Parker was really good, and it was really cute. Judging by the casting of the movie, I don't think we're going to get much of that in the first one, at least. Seeing as they seem to have chosen Gwen Stacy as the female love interest, which is cool because I like the whole Gwen Stacy story in general.
Yeah, that feels weird to me because I've only ever known her as a dead character.
Really?
Yeah.
I've read the comics where she dies.
But isn't there a comic where she dies? That's from so long ago.
Yeah, okay.
That's from... In current continuity, Spider-Man, she's been dead for however many years.
Yeah,
like, they killed her off in, I think, the early 1970s. And because Marvel has never done like a reset on their continuity, they just kind of like, well, everything happened.
Yeah.
In sort of a rough timeline of things. So I've only ever known her as a dead character and as sort of a symbolic of his failures. Like, he talks about having been in love with her, but I mean, I haven't really read much where that's going on. I just kind of know her as a memory to him.
Okay.
So I mean, it'll be weird to like, oh my God, she's going to die. They're going to kill her. She's going to die in this movie, and it's going to be tragic. And it's really weird how it happens because she gets thrown off the bridge. Like, if you've seen Spider-Man 1, it's that moment where she gets thrown off the bridge, except instead of saving her and the kids, he webs her back or something, trying to catch her, and it snaps her neck. She doesn't hit the water. He snaps her neck with a web, and it's really sort of, it's a strange looking panel, and it's really heavy and weird, but that's what I'm thinking at the time. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I'm not sold on the idea that they're going to kill her in the first movie.
No, no. They've said that she signed on for multiple movies. I don't think that would happen. That would be too much. That wouldn't be a teen movie. That would just be, I don't know, depressing.
Yeah.
Like,
but that's perfect sequel fodder, I think.
I guess. No. I don't know.
I tend to use Richard Donner's 1978, I think, Superman, as sort of the beginning of the comic book movie as we know it, where you sort of get the origin story. You've got some top-of-the-line special effects for whatever time period it was. Like, it was a big deal that Superman could make a man fly. Like, that was,
believe a man could fly.
Yeah, that was their tagline, basically. Has the basic format for a superhero movie changed much since then, if at all?
I think yes, but I think not enough.
Okay.
Not to the point where they're telling stories of these characters that have matured, or we're not at the point where you can just say, okay, it's a superhero movie. You can get past the knowing why they do what they do. It's kind of, that's always the crux of it. I think The Dark Knight, they don't really, the second Christopher Nolan Batman movie, they don't really say much about his parents or why he started doing what he does. The second Spider-Man, like sequels, yeah, but not really in a first movie.
Yeah, in the first movie, it's sort of always got to be the origin.
I guess Thor's not really an origin, but it is. But in a way, it's more of a hero's journey than other ones that are origin stories. Daredevil had a bit less of that. Like, it's kind of done away with very quickly. And it has a little bit more to do with the middle of his superheroing life.
Yep.
I'd like to see more of it.
Yeah.
I'd like to see them do... The problem is letting people know why this person is doing what is normally a crazy thing to do.
Okay.
You would have to have a reason for doing it. It's not an occupation.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like, okay, your main character's a firefighter, but we need to explain why he's going to places with a hose and putting out fires. So you don't need to explain that. That's a profession. People do that. And I think that you would need to condense it. The Dark Knight, it's Batman. Everybody knows why he does what he does. You can kind of take it for granted. You don't really have to explain it to get into the meat of the story. The second Iron Man did a good job of condensing it, I think, with the sort of montage in the credits, and there was news footage during Whiplash's whole scene there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Superman Returns, there was a sort of a Star Wars-y scroll at the beginning of it, just text, which I think is kind of cool, but and it's kind of cutesy to me because it's very nostalgic. It feels very like, 1970s, like you can do this sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I think kids now, especially these... The damn kids. We hate Terrence Howard and we hate kids. That's one thing I can say about my experiences at the MacGuffin Men offices.
Yeah, there's just...
He's got a whole wall here of pictures of children with the eyes crossed out in red marker. So if you're near a phone, call the police.
And also a Hustle and Flow poster with a big red X on it as well.
What were we talking about? Not having the origin story?
Yeah, the basic format of superhero movies.
No, like they're all origin stories, I think, except for the sequels. Oh, The Incredible Hulk with Ed Norton, which is kind of a sequel, but kind of not. But the only problem with, and I watched that last week.
Yeah, the Bourne Identity with monsters.
It's great, but there's nothing different at the end of the movie than at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
There's nothing has been accomplished. That movie...
Well, things got destroyed.
kind of.
Buildings, hearts.
And after having lived with Toronto, I recognized a lot more of it, which was kind of cool. It's like, oh, there's U of T and there's downtown. And yeah, no, but there's nothing of consequence. I think this is why I started talking about Bourne Again, other than that I'd read it recently, is that... It starts, he's Daredevil, he has his life destroyed, and there's no magic reset button at the end. Like, he's still not destitute, but he doesn't really have resources anymore. Okay. He's just kind of, it's a deconstruction thing. And that's where, I think that's what a lot of the bigger superhero titles were doing in the 1980s that are currently being reprinted. Like, The Dark Knight Returns, Watchmen, Daredevil Born Again, they're these sort of like they're tearing down of the hero so he can discover some sort of essential quality or reason or whatever.
Yep.
You know, Spider-Man gets his groove back and, and he comes back reinvigorated or with a renewed sense of purpose or something has changed. But I don't think that we've gotten to the point where people are just okay walking into a superhero movie without having to have it explained to them why.
Okay.
Which is weird, considering people complaining about the sort of oversaturation of these things. But I mean, they're still distilling them so much.
Like, yep. I agree. I was just curious to see if you had any.
No, I think it would be really cool. And they're talking about doing another series of Batman movies after the current one is finished.
Oh yeah,
summer.
It's gonna happen.
But I think it would be really cool if they didn't do a framing story. If they just did something like, I don't know, The Long Halloween, or like just do a story.
I want to see Arkham Asylum as a movie. That's
really?
Yeah.
Like directed by David Lynch?
Yeah, that would work.
Oh, you mean the video game or
the comic book. I love that. That's one of my favorite books.
It is so good. And
the art's incredible too.
Yeah, Dave McKean, who has done a lot of work for Vertigo, a lot of covers. I think because of the time consuming nature of it, it's a lot of found objects and weird painting techniques, yep, and everything looks very strange. And I found it like kind of hard to follow in parts because the lettering is a little weird.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I want them to just do a story without feeling like they have to dispense with the origin. And that's kind of my fear for all these. I think we're entering the second wave of reboots now, because next summer there's a Spider-Man movie coming out and a Superman movie coming out.
Yep.
It's not like the last Superman movie where you can say, okay, well, it's been 20 years. We're going to start over. Yep. They're restarting these things every 10 years now. And I don't know how different the artistic takes are going to be. And if they're doing the origin story again, like he's rocketed from Krypton, he spends time at Smallville, like get on with it. Like get it. Everyone knows about that. Although I did sort of write down some extra points that I wanted to make about that. Did I talk to you about the DC thing that they're doing?
We've talked about it briefly, but why don't you sort of give us a rundown?
DC Comics as of September is effectively committing brand suicide and starting everything over. They've done this sort of once in the past in 1986, where they sort of hit a reset button on their continuity. So all of the things in the story universe just sort of get shoved aside for something new. They're canceling every title, which they didn't even do then. They're canceling Action Comics, which is the longest running serial publication. They had their 900th issue this year, and they're restarting it with Number One, and it's been running for 70 years. And Detective Comics as well. For the first time, it's been getting completely reset to a Number One.
And so Action Comics is where Superman started out, right?
Yes.
And Action Comics Detective Comics was where Batman got to start.
And the interesting thing that one of the sort of things about that is coming out of this is it feels like the change, and they haven't said this much, but it feels like the change to Superman's origin is going to be a lot more significant than it had been in the past, in part due to a copyright case that the Siegel family has against Time Warner.
Okay.
That's been going on for years and years and years. Because comic book creation was essentially sort of artistic slave labor in the 1930s and 40s and 50s even, where you sort of have these, it's only work for hire agreements. So right now, if you go see Sin City, Frank Miller gets a piece of that money because he created Sin City, he owns it. Dark Horse Comics publishes it, and I don't know what the studio is.
We'll go with Fox.
Sure.
That sounds right.
Frank Miller still owns the characters, and he was one of the first creators to sort of really assert himself this way by doing creator-owned work that was big. Mark Millar is the guy doing it, is sort of the big guy doing it currently, who created Kick-Ass, Wanted, Nemesis is a comic that it will eventually be a movie. But the Seagulls and Bill Finger, who co-created Batman, although he doesn't get credit for it, these were works for hire. So they essentially got $130, a pat on the back, and a salary. And now that Superman has become the next big thing since Mickey Mouse in terms of popular culture symbols, is their family hasn't benefited from it. Jack Kirby is another name that is sort of, the Kirby family has been involved in lawsuits because
he was a big part of the Marvel.
Yeah, he was. I arguably the biggest.
Okay.
Stan Lee has credit over all of those things now, I think just because he was a little bit more business savvy. Mm-hmm. And he's had a lot of pressure in the comics, not pressure, but a lot of hate leveled against him in the comics community. Jack Kirby's son recently did a Father's Day sort of letter, which was basically an angry letter to Stan Lee. And it ended with the phrase, "How does it feel to be the last man standing?" Which is how a lot of these people feel about, I think Stan Lee is the only person, and Bob Kane are the only people to sort of ride on the backs of their former artistic co-creators.
Okay.
Anyways, so the core of this lawsuit is that they want to take back the things that I think it's the Siegel family created in the first four issues of Action Comics. So from what I remember, that's Krypton, the Kindly Couple, but not the Kents by name.
Okay.
Lois Lane, the Daily Star, and parts of the costume. So the theory is that since they may be winning this lawsuit, apparently they're past it settling. Like, there's so much bad blood between this family and Time Warner that they're not going to settle. So that's the theory, is that they're changing the comics fee so that they won't end up having to continue to pay all these royalties to this family, because this has just gotten so ugly. There will be parts of the Superman story stripped away. So my question for you, and if Brent's been listening, I'm not sure. How worthwhile is Superman as an intellectual property if all of those elements get split up?
Well, it certainly changes, because, I mean, Superman is sort of one of those, is probably the worldwide the most well-known superhero. And I don't think that's a big
other
stretch.
Other than Mickey Mouse, I can't think of anything else that's more recognizable from North American popular culture.
Yeah, because the general consensus on Superman now among, I suppose, youth is that Superman is kind of the lame superhero. But that doesn't make him any less relevant pop culturally as far as people recognizing him and knowing his story. And it's the most ingrained because, I mean, it was the first big superhero movie is Superman. And that's how most of us get it. And I think changing it up won't change how most people perceive Superman, though. Because I think that sort of change would... Comics aren't as big enough of a deal that people would notice.
Right. But you're also talking about... That would also mean licensing. That means no more Superman lunchboxes with his current costume.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No more blanket sets. No more other media interpretations. Well, yeah. That's why they're doing the Zack Snyder film sort of on the fast track, because they had to get a movie started before 2011. Otherwise, they were going to immediately lose these rights, which are still sort of up in the air, but it really sounds like it's going to go the way of the Siegels winning. I forget whether or not it's the Siegels or the Schusters, but it's one of the two families that's currently suing. So for Time Warner, what is, like, do you have anything?
I just think as long as you've got the name, you've still got the business case. I mean, I'm not even speaking to culture or quality or anything, but as long as you can still say Superman, then you're gonna, I mean, you've got that asset there, and regardless of whether you have to give up some of the elements of the story, the brand is still huge, and it's still profit.
Yeah. Okay. As long as you still get the name Superman, I think the elements of the character that would have to be stripped away would sort of fade over time, but Brent is right. And for those listening at home, that was Brent. He's been quietly listening and counting his money in the background of this podcast.
It's our producer.
He's producing this episode.
I actually just signed a deal with him. I'm going to be the new host of the MacGuffin Man, and you can be on after me on the Alex show.
Travis is doing it for half the price. That's great.
I feel like I'm getting Siegled here.
A little. Yeah. I wouldn't start throwing that around. Anyways, I thought that was really interesting, and I was just kind of curious to get some outside opinion. Like, I've got my head in the sand for the comic books; it's a big deal. But
Superman is
a huge property.
Yeah, and then what is your opinion about this? And I suppose how is the comics community in general sort of taking this?
Well, DC's taking a big gamble doing this big rebranding thing.
Huge gamble.
Well, they recently came under more direct management in Time Warner, and they managed their comic books in a very different way than Marvel. Marvel kind of lets a lot of the creators run with it, and from a distance, following them on Twitter and reading blogs and things like that, I'm under the impression that a lot more of the Marvel creators collaborate and sort of can coordinate things that make sort of sense, and like everybody's kind of allowed to do their artistic thing. DC has a lot more sort of editorial mandates handed down from above, from what I understand.
Is DC big enough for Time Warner to give a shit about it?
I think in terms of IP right now, with like we're doing a podcast on it, it's become a bigger source of money. Like The Dark Knight was the highest grossing film of all time.
It was second.
They're spending enough money and not really making a lot. Like realistically, there's like 60,000. I think I read it somewhere. 60,000 people following comics. Like, so there are 60,000 of me, which is not a lot of people. It's not as many people that go to the movies every summer. But in terms of profit, they could be making more. And for IP, like to push those characters into movies, it's potential money. It's an idea farm, basically.
But alienating the comic community is
They don't. No, that's why they're doing it. Yeah. The other thing that's going sort of hand in hand with this relaunch thing is that they're doing what's called day and date, which I guess is a redundant term now, digital distribution of their titles, which they never did before, which theoretically could kill a lot of retailers, but maybe, maybe not. So you could read every DC comic on your iPad. For those of you that thought that you could do it already, you totally can't, which is speaks to the backwardness of the whole industry. So yeah, every title is going to be available the day that it is released on in a digital format, which is the other big initiative. So, I mean, that's a big business deal for them. There's the potential for, they're always kind of looking for this mystery new audience. Like, I don't know what kids want. I mean, maybe they want comics.
Comics on an iPad.
Yeah, I mean,
kids.
So there's room to make money. I think, I'm not sure. This will, I presumably, we'll find out.
So yeah, we're sort of going back to the movies now, where do you have any favorite comic book movie sequels? And I mean, we've sort of mentioned in
X2, passing. X2, Spider-Man 2, The Dark Knight, those are the big ones. Yeah. I think Spider-Man 2 is my high pick of those three, maybe.
My thing with Spider-Man 2 is, and I was a huge fan of it when it first came out, I haven't seen it in a couple years. I think it was probably like second year university where I last saw it. All of the dialogue scenes are really, really bad. Specifically, anything with James Franco, and this is before James Franco became like became a walking meme. So like, this isn't me being like, ha ha ha, this is the guy that hosted the Oscars.
I liked him in those movies.
When he's just like, he's just drinking the champagne, and he can't like get the champagne in his mouth. He's like, no, I'm not gonna stop. I'm gonna hunt the bug 24/7. And he calls him the bug, and then slaps Peter in the face, and then slaps Peter
that
in the face
perfect.
Again. That was so.
We need more man-to-man slap time in Summer Ball.
Well, it's hilarious, but I mean, I don't think it's the type of hilarious they were going for with that scene.
It felt a little silly, and I think it fit the tone. I mean, my only complaint is Peter and Mary Jane's chemistry. For me, I really buy Dr. Octopus and his wife being sort of this reflection of Peter Parker and him going down this ultimately tragic path, and I thought it was structured really well, and it did the best job of juggling all these plot elements, the Harry story, Dr. Octopus, Aunt May, Peter, and paying the rent, and him maybe losing his powers or like losing his desire to do it.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot about that aspect.
Yeah, see? I don't know. I like that.
I agree that it is a good movie. I'm just saying like some of it is really corny.
I watched it last week and I was sad to find that I don't think that The Dark Knight holds up as well as I had thought at the time.
Okay, that's fair.
Some of the speeches, like, there's no James Gordon speech at the end of Spider-Man 2. It just felt like, why is he telling his son about...
No, I agree. Like, I like that speech, but I agree that it doesn't make sense.
Even him having that conversation with an adult, somebody would be interrupting. I'm like, what do you mean?
Like, there's a lot of monologuing in The Dark Knight.
Yeah, and it doesn't... I don't think it works. I think that they were looking for an excuse to have a voiceover, and it just kind of felt sloppy. And it changes tones. It changes tone in the third act. It becomes sort of this weird thing where, like, there are characters and they're talking for the movie, and then all of a sudden the Joker's hanging upside down and then Batman is having this like, well, people are good conversation with them.
Yep.
It's like they're action figures talking and like they're making these interesting points, but it just kind of felt like, well, okay, let's move on. Like,
see, that was the thing about that movie that I did enjoy, in that it seemed very comic booky, in that there were just these sort of like in the way they would converse, like,
but
sort of these long monologues that sort of don't really make sense to exist in real life. But since this is sort of like a comic book property, you can kind of, you know, like the villain monologuing at the end instead of just killing James Bond right off the bat or something like that. It felt kind of like that. But, you know, it just felt like it fit, but it didn't. It clearly doesn't really make
much
sense.
I mean, it felt like it shifted halfway through where the monologuing stopped making sense at a certain point. And there was just, I don't know. I think I want to see a directly adapted, like, I don't want to see a summer blockbuster superhero movie. I mean, I'm kind of, at one point, Darren Aronofsky was going to do a Batman Year One.
Yeah.
And there were screwed up elements where, like,
yeah, there
he
was a
living
lot of weird
in a garage or something like that. But it also kind of got me pumped for, like, make a really low budget Batman movie where he's in gray tights and he's insane and people are getting punched in the face and like you don't actually want to really be watching the violence on screen. You kind of like where you would have to turn away and do it, play it straight.
You know you're never
going to
see that.
I know
though,
I'm
right?
not going to. That's the problem.
There's too much money in these things.
I'm never going to get
too much money to be made.
My artistically satisfied superhero movies.
Yeah.
I'm going to get
I don't know. I'm going to get X-Tree every year for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Well, but occasionally you'll get something like Dark Knight or Spider-Man 2 that is good while being flawed.
Yeah. I guess so.
Any particularly bad sequels other than the next three, which we have talked about? The one thing about X3 that really blew me away, I'll just make this point quick, is that after I watched it, I was like, that is the fastest paced movie I've ever seen in my life.
That's a selling point for Ben Barron.
That movie starts and then it's over and you're like, what happened?
I have the attention span of a goldfish, so it worked really well for me.
We watched Star Trek First Contact and they go back in time and we looked at the running time. It was like 10 minutes into the movie and Brent looked at me. He's like, this is very economically paced. This is probably my favorite part of it. They get right to it. There's no explaining, no fucking around. Iron Man 2, I don't think they knew really what they wanted to do with it. Like the studio turned it into this Avengers thing. And from what I understand recently is that they didn't have that on the first Iron Man. They had this sort of creative freedom where they could do what they want. And the shield thing was tacked on as an afterthought.
Iron Man was sort of Marvel didn't expect it to be nearly as big as it was. That's why they allowed sort of Jon Favreau to direct it and Robert Downey Jr. to be Iron Man, right? And Jon Favreau's whole thing when that movie was starting was Robert Downey Jr. is my Iron Man. Like, you can't change that, right? If they had more faith in that, the studio wouldn't be listening to Jon Favreau say something like, I did D'Zathura, you have to listen to me, you know?
The second one looked better. Like, the second one was better, better paced, and it looked better. Like, Jon Favreau learned how to do this kind of movie.
Yes, I agree with that.
But the character reverts. Like, I think they get the characters, but I don't think that they got that there should be some sort of arc. Like I was saying about the Hulk, like, something needs to be different. Something needs to have been achieved in terms of these characters and how they feel about the world and how they interact with things. But, like, Tony Stark reverts at the beginning of the first one. At the beginning of the second one, and he's just an asshole again. And I never really bought his reasoning for keeping Iron Man from the United States government. It didn't.
Oh yeah,
it didn't. Him like sitting on the technology. They didn't feel like they explained that.
Yeah,
Whiplash was cool, but he just kind of shows up at the end and then kills himself.
The thing I felt about Iron Man 2, I thought there were a lot of points where I was like, this is kind of, and it was weird because it was. Or I guess it was probably 2 years after The Dark Knight. There were a couple points where I was like, this really feels like The Dark Knight, like where sort of Iron Man, or sorry, I guess Tony Stark and Whiplash have their sort of one-on-one conversation in a jail cell. I was like, this is really close. And
he's more dismissive, I think. And I liked that part of it. Like, it felt like it was setting it up for a long conversation in the prison cell, but it was like, oh, Tony Stark is being like dismissive of him. Okay. Like that kind of worked.
Okay. Yeah. And I mean, I haven't seen it since it was first in theaters and I only saw it once, but the only other thing I really remember from that movie is Sam Rockwell's monologue about weapons that I really enjoyed, where he calls like a giant bullet the ex-wife or something.
The cast was really good. Like the
Don
new
Cheadle.
Cast.
Don Cheadle was totally wasted, and Don Cheadle is probably the best working actor right now.
The cast was. I don't think Don Cheadle was a good James Rhodes though.
I agree.
In the comics, I'm thinking being like a little bigger, a little bit more aggressive to Tony, whereas Don Cheadle felt he was just kind of being like passive aggressive to voice his complaints. I talked with a friend of mine about this recently, and he was saying that he had thought that. All of these other crazy things like the new element, the blood poisoning, his relationship with Pepper, Rhodey, that there were stand-ins for alcoholism. And they more or less admitted to that recently, that they couldn't. And it's not just him getting drunk. It's not like Mad Men alcoholism where they're just kind of like sauced and that's a commentary. Like in the comics, he's homeless for a lot of it. And he gets drunk in the suit, like in the movie, actually. I think that was the... Most interesting part of it.
That's true.
I think it was played for laughs a little too much.
Yeah.
Whereas in the comic, like, I think he seriously hurts somebody, and it's a little bit more like, what are you doing to yourself? You're self-destructing. And all those other things that they put in this movie were kind of like summer blockbuster stand-ins for this problem, but instead he discovers a new element and he cures. Like, that was the stand-in for curing alcoholism, because in a movie like that, you wouldn't be able to have a resolution to alcoholism. Like, I think it would have been cool if they had ended it with him attending AA or something like that. In the comics, he's sober now, and that's a big part of his character. He talks a lot about having been an alcoholic, and it's sort of a big part of his decision making process.
So one thing that I find really interesting about comic movies now, or comic movies that are now being created, is the Marvel Universe. And the way Marvel is now sort of owns the filmmaking rights to a lot of their properties, and they are making these films. Can you give us a quick rundown on this whole idea of the Marvel movie universe?
Yeah. In the 90s, Marvel sort of oversaturated the market with comic books, and there were variant covers, and kids all of a sudden stopped. Not all of a sudden, but they oversaturated the market, and they ended up having to file for bankruptcy. And this is when they were an independent company. They had no larger body funding Marvel. There was no fallback. So they filed for bankruptcy. They ended up having to sell a lot of their properties, such as Ghost Rider, the X-Men, Spider-Man. So that's why you see a lot of these occurring in self-contained universes. They held on to a few lucrative ones and won a few back, actually. The Hulk was at one point owned by Fox, I think.
Yep. Yeah, okay.
And is now owned by Marvel again. With the first Iron
thanks,
Man...
Thanks, Ang Lee, for that one.
I liked that one. I thought it was good.
No, I did not. When he backhand slaps a dog, I enjoyed that. But other than that...
Yeah. So they did have sort of their Avengers-based properties. Captain America, Iron Man, and Thor, who were sort of B characters. Like, they weren't really known in among the larger public.
Okay.
Iron Man was the first movie completely funded by Marvel Studios, and it was kind of like, well, if this isn't it, that's the end of the movie studio. That, like, Marvel Studios is no more. Okay. But it did very well. They added sort of a fun scene with Nick Fury and Samuel L. Jackson, who had... several years prior, sold his likeness rights to Marvel to use in the Ultimate Marvel Universe, which is sort of an alternate, new, modernized Marvel Universe.
And which is a deal that is really working out for him.
Yeah. Well, he's signed up for something like 9 pictures now.
Yeah.
Anyway, so with this scene, they decided, okay, well, what if we made a couple more movies? What if we made, I don't know, Thor and Captain America and then have them all meet in the Avengers? And it's just kind of like a comic book fan's way of looking at movies. I mean, they've done it sort of with Easter eggs in other movies. Mm-hmm. If you watch Predator 2, there's an alien skull, and that's beginning of that sort of way of thinking. And Freddy versus Jason was a comic book first, just kind of having these things meet because, well, it's not ridiculous. They're already ridiculous concepts. Why not have them ridiculously meet? And they're building it up to the Avengers, which is coming out next summer, which somehow Joss Whedon is working on. Still doesn't make sense. I'm waiting for him to get fired from that.
Yeah.
It's funny reading some of the more snarky movie blogs that are kind of waiting for the Avengers to be this disaster. And I'm thinking of the only other movie that Joss Whedon has directed was the most sort of tonally consistent ensemble movie that I've ever seen, Serenity, which I love. I think Serenity is wonderful. And he directed it. He knows how to work with a small budget, which is one thing that he's been given, right? Like, the Avengers is not being made for a lot of money right now. So I don't know. It's crazy, but it might work.
Yeah.
It's a little weird because they've kind of forced these awkward cameos into other movies, scenes with S.H.I.E.L.D. agents, like in Thor. It kind of works in some spots, but it kind of doesn't work because they're trying to tie it together. But
the Hawkeye cameo in Thor in general was very clearly thrown in.
Well, yeah, if you watch it, he doesn't speak to anybody. It's done in reshoots, clearly. So, I don't know. The casting has been good. Like, Mark Ruffalo is supposedly playing the Hulk because, I don't know.
Edward Norton's a dick.
Ed Norton don't work for scale.
Yeah.
Jeremy Renner looks exactly like, if you read Mark Millar's The Ultimates, which is the ultimate version of the Avengers. The line is called Ultimate. I'm not ascribing that word to it. There's Ultimate Spider-Man, Ultimate X-Men, and The Ultimates originally. He's exactly like the Hawkeye in those comics. Just a guy with a bow. So I don't know. It could be okay. It's an interesting idea. It doesn't work with blockbuster logic because then you end up having to pay people that were the lead actors in their own movies to be all in this one movie. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how it's going to work out. It's strange.
Yeah, no, it's very strange, and that's why I'm really excited. Like, this is the sort of first really new, really high risk thing that has been done in blockbusters in a long time. Like, this is pretty big, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of anything else, like any other precedent for this.
And it's just rare that you get something this sort of unique in blockbusters.
It's a unique formula, but I'm not sure that it's high risk because they've been doing the other movies for a relatively small amount of money.
Yeah, I guess all things considered.
Like Thor is not going to. Thor did not cost as much as, I don't know, Transformers.
Yeah, no.
Or even true. Green Lantern, I bet.
Oh yeah, definitely didn't cost as much as Green Lantern. But you can sort of see that in... The Marvel movies have all looked like Iron Man and Thor specifically, I thought, sort of looked a little bit less expensive than, Dark Knight looked really expensive, and so did Transformers, but not really a comic book thing.
We were kind of talking about this earlier, and like I said, I had been talking to this other friend about how a place looks, and we haven't really seen a lot of... successfully, like, they don't look inhabited other than places that are basically doing New York. Mm-hmm. The Dark Knight was done in Chicago. It looked like an actual city. You were looking at buildings, around buildings, in the skyline. You were looking out of windows into these big expanses.
Yeah.
None of it looked like a set.
Yeah.
And I think that they haven't really accomplished that with any of the other... The Incredible Hulk did, which I was kind of surprised on rewatching it. And I think that was because of the director. I think Louis
Leterrier
had done that sort of thing before. But like John Favreau didn't really fill the world of Iron Man with people. Like it doesn't, it's so isolated looking.
Mm-hmm.
Thor is in the middle of nowhere. But at the same time, even for that size of a town, there didn't look like there was anybody that lived there.
It looked like
a ghost town.
Yeah.
Even though it was kind of small, it looked like really small when you consider the amount of people that you saw.
Yeah, I agree.
So I think that's the biggest obstacle. The Spider-Man movies did a great job of that. They really looked like an inhabited New York. There were people walking around. Like, it kind of looked like the population density was about right.
Mm-hmm.
I hope they do that with the Avengers. I mean, like I said, Joss Whedon is really good with working with a small amount of money, but then again, Serenity also took place largely in space, not with a huge amount of people. And although he was very clever with, I think, cutting away at the right time to sort of imply that there were more people present than there necessarily were. Like, if you were to do like a close shot-by-shot look at Serenity, I'm sure there would be a smaller number of people than I'm picturing in my mind.
Okay.
So that's the sort of thing that I would like to see more of.
Yeah, all right, that's cool. And I agree. I think it sort of takes me right out of a movie when something looks like it's happening on a set. Like, I know it's happening on a set. Don't give me that second reminder, you know?
Yeah.
Do you find it, like, unfortunate at all that the X-Men or Spider-Man won't really appear in the sort of any Avengers movie? Or do you think it's fine that they're on their own?
I mean, yeah.
Because the X-Men are sort of an Avengers of their own, you know? They've got enough characters.
Yeah. I think with X-Men... You wouldn't be able to apply sort of comic book logic to a lot of the storylines. I mean, the X-Men fight to save a world that hates and fears them. That's the tagline of the X-Men. And they can't really exist with the metaphor intact in a world that's populated by people with superpowers.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of need to be the only people with superpowers. In comics, there's a whole thing about like, oh, well, their genes are different and it's an evolutionary thing and people are afraid of that. But I mean, realistically, you're afraid of them because they've got fucking powers.
Yeah.
Spider-Man, I mean, it depends on Spider-Man's relationship with the city. If it's a movie where you want to set it up and he's hated by the city because he's a sort of a freak or a criminal or whatever, you can't really have him with other people running around at the same time. It just, the relationship doesn't really work that way.
Yep.
I mean, these are all coincidental outcomes of Marvel having sold off their biggest properties, but I think it kind of works.
Okay. I only ask because I know I've seen Spider-Man sort of team up with, I think it was probably in the Civil War, I read.
Yeah, for the last 5 or 6 years, Spider-Man and Wolverine have both been part of the main Avengers team, which was absolutely not the case before that. There was like sort of sacrosanct that you don't have certain players on the Avengers
team. Okay, fair enough. Well, I guess, is there anything else really interesting and really creative that you think is happening in the world of comic book film that we haven't touched on yet?
You're going to hate me for this, but I'm excited for Green Lantern.
That's fun.
I think it's the only one that's sort of done they're going to be the first one to do a space thing. I mean, the X-Men in the comics are in space on a regular basis, or the Avengers. But I mean, and even Superman, you don't really see in space in the movies. He's just kind of Metropolis. And to do this sort of movie that no one has heard of, doing it mostly in space, like most of that movie is going to take place off planet. I think it's an interesting concept. I mean, it's ambitious and it might sort of kick them in the butt as far as the effects are concerned. I don't know. They've been running right down to the wire in terms of rendering on it.
Yeah.
But it's ambitious.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah. They're hoping that it's going to be their Iron Man. I don't necessarily think so. I think that it'll appeal more to kids, though. I think you could show a kid that last Green Lantern trailer that actually explains what's going on, and it would work. I don't know.
I think I agree with that. My main aversion to the Green Lantern thing is I don't want to see things happen in space. I don't like movies.
Alex Stevens in fuck space. I don't want to see it.
In general, I don't like period pieces, and I don't like movies that take place in space for the most part.
So what about a period piece in space?
If there was
an old abandoned mining town on Mars.
Yeah, Pride and Prejudice on Mars. Yeah, whatever.
That would be great.
I like movies to happen.
I would love that. I like period pieces and space.
We're
the odd couple.
I just like movies to sort of happen in a place that I recognize generally. And I mean, that's not to say there aren't exceptions to these things. Like, I love Alien, that's all in space, you know? It's just, in general, a period piece or a movie taking place in space is a harder sell for me. And I'm getting more and more sold on Green Lantern. I'm going to see it regardless, just because that's how I am. But yeah, I'm more confident about it now, but
they dropped the ball on marketing. Like, it's kind of like with Thor. When I finished seeing Thor, my first thought was, well, for an hour and a half, they explained a lot of stuff that I had kind of taken for granted. And I think that was the problem with Green Lantern in the first two trailers. You see these guys sort of flying around, and Ryan Reynolds, and they didn't explain in that trailer who the Green Lantern Corps are.
Okay.
And I didn't even think of that until I saw the last one, and it's all voiceovers and all that.
Yep.
The Guardians of the Universe and blah, blah, blah. And it's kind of like the Star Wars thing where they're explaining the backstory, and they just didn't do that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I'm excited for it.
Well, yeah. And just going back to my point about like space and period pieces, like Thor, about half of it took place in Asgard, which is the same thing as space to me. And I mean, that was my problem with Thor, is that I didn't really care for that part that much. But anyway, sort of just moving on, are there any other sort of, like, is there anything coming out as far as comic book movies that really jumps out at you? I know we've talked about Avengers and Green Lantern, but
I was excited for Wolverine when Darren Aronofsky was.
Everybody was excited about that. The buzz that would have been crazy.
It would have been. I think I was kind of hoping for it to be like at the end of the Wolverine, he discovers that he's actually just a homeless psychopath and he's murdered all of his friends. And he's imagined the X-Men for the entire movie, and it ends with him with like knives taped to his fists. And then he bleeds out.
Yeah. Nothing about Darren Aronofsky making Wolverine with Hugh Jackman sounds unappealing, you know?
But it's obviously not happening now. Yeah. And there have been like three people that were really great turn it down in the last couple of weeks who have come out publicly and been like, nope, not doing it.
Who was it?
Mark Romanek was one of them.
Okay.
I want to say maybe Matthew Vaughn was on the list.
Okay.
And they were all like people that hadn't done that sort of movie before. Had you seen the guy that directed the first Wolverine movie also did a movie called, if I'm pronouncing
Sotsy?
This right. Sotsy, yeah.
Have you seen it? I never saw it.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, I've always heard good things.
I was really excited for the first one. I was like, the guy that did Sotsy is doing Wolverine. That's going to be nuts. And then it was garbage.
Yeah.
It was terrible.
Yeah.
I think I attribute that to him not being able to navigate the waters politically to do that sort of movie. Because you obviously would have to make sacrifices or be super assertive, a la Matthew Vaughn or even Bryan Singer, I think. But since then, I don't know, it'll probably be a terrible. let's see, what else? I don't really care for Zack Snyder at all, so the next Superman movie, Dark Knight Rises could be cool. I like that they're tying it back to the first one with the League of Assassins.
Yep.
Iron Man 3 with Shane Black. I just watched Kiss Kiss Bang Bang the other day.
Such a good movie.
Oh my god. It looked better than I remembered it too.
Oh, it's a really good movie all through.
I was like, I knew the script. I remembered liking the script, but I didn't remember it looking so much like a city and all the crazy color changes in it. It felt big. It felt comic booky. Like, it was cool.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Amazing Spider-Man. If Mark Webb doesn't sort of teen movie style or similar to 500 Days of Summer, that'll be cool.
Yeah, I agree. That is
the Avengers. I mean, I think we're hitting the plateau. Depending on which of these directors gets fired, because obviously the the directors are not going to be all the same by the time these projects come out. They're notorious for people leaving these projects. Yep. And the screenplay is getting rewritten and rewritten and rewritten and rewritten. So we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing I'm really overly excited about other than, I think Dark Knight Rises, just because, you know, I'm a big Christopher Nolan fan, as anybody that's listened to one podcast of ours already knows. And I'm really excited for The Amazing Spider-Man, just because of the whole teen movie Spider-Man thing. But yeah, it's...
For the record, I think that The Prestige was better than Inception.
Okay. That's fine.
By far.
I understand that argument, my Inception argument there. And I don't know which one I think is better. I think Memento is better than both. My Inception argument is that Inception has the giant grand scale. You know, and that's something that appeals to me.
Or I could just be a jerk and say, like, oh, Following. I won't watch anything by him after Following.
Yeah, Memento, we got way too mainstream.
If it's got color, I don't want it. If it's got if it's got color and is in space and is a period piece, I don't care for it. I want it to be black and white, set in my home right now, and I won't watch it after now.
And I want to be able to do a podcast on it live as it's filming.
Do you remember Kevin Smith releasing podcasts for Clerks 2 when it was in theaters?
No.
And encouraging, yeah, he encouraged people to go to the theater with their iPod on and listen to his commentary on it.
I hate that guy. Hate Kevin
Smith.
Why do
you hate him?
I think he did incredible things for, I think Clerks did really good things for independent filmmaking in general, but Kevin Smith as a person.
A lot of the later
so
ones
arrogant.
Don't hold up as much as I thought they did. I saw Chasing Amy like a couple years ago.
Oh, yeah, no. None of his movies were
I remember,
up well.
I loved it. Like 2 years ago, I thought Chasing Amy was one of my favorite movies. But
yeah,
now,
I haven't watched it since high school because I know it's going to offend me. You know, like it's
it's more sexist than I had thought, actually.
Yeah.
Although he did, and to come back to Daredevil, he wrote one of the best Daredevil runs that I've read. And it's not Kevin Smithy. It's like he did a Green Arrow run, which is very like, oh, it's a Kevin Smith movie with Green Arrow. And his Daredevil book was very, it was Daredevil, and it was very talky, but it wasn't Kevin Smithy.
Oh, okay. Cool.
It was great.
Well, thank you for joining us on the MacGuffin, man.
Thank you for having me. Sorry for talking too much.
No, it's fine. They've turned it off if they don't want to listen. If they've made it to this part, they loved it.
should we do the credits and then an after credits scene where
Fury
shows
up? You'll stick around and Samuel Jackson's going to show up in a couple minutes. So
punch us both in the face and leave.
So thanks for listening, everybody. And yeah, we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. This episode has been brought to you by Fruit Carts. Come on, Chase Scenes, what did we ever do to you? Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.